Afternoon, everybody. So, just so I got an idea who all I'm talking to, how many people in here are already licensed amateur radio operators? Oh, good heavens, you're going to be bored to tears for the first half of this talk. Wow, more than I anticipated. That's wonderful. So, we'll start off with, what is radio? And this was an anecdote that has many different attributions. I was never able to track it back to the source. But somebody, when asked, what is radio, explained that, consider that you have a telegraph that is essentially a long cat. You pull its tail in New York, and it meows in Los Angeles, and you send your message. Now, consider the radio. It's the same as that telegraph, only there's no cat. So, what exactly is amateur radio? Well, the problem is, amateur radio is so diverse in so many different operation modes and different communities that it's difficult to kind of express in any one way. So, what I'm going to try and show is a little bit about some of my experiences and some of my viewpoints, and then hopefully let you start to explore that for yourself. So this is actually came from the Wikipedia page on the history of ham radio, and this was taken in the 1920s. I think it says 1924 in Germany. This is basically one of the early radio enthusiasts out doing his thing. You can see the rather large pack on the front there that is his radio. So pretty big equipment, of course, pretty big antenna. I suppose now that you see a lot of war driving and war walking, I suppose this would be a very early war skiing. But nowadays, radios are a lot smaller. They all fit in the palm of our hands. We've all got these things now, too. Definitely a lot of improvements in technology that make things smaller, easier to work with. But of course, your station can be as big as it needs to as well, depending on what you're trying to do. This is actually someone's shortwave station. You got various different radios, antenna tuners, etc. So, one of the big events that occurs in amateur radio is this field day. And it is essentially sort of three different events in one. On one hand, it's an emergency preparedness event. The idea is you go out into the field, as the name suggests, and you set up a station from scratch with as much emergency power and non-pre-existing infrastructure as possible to kind of see how it can go. The second is it's a contest. Everybody goes out on the same weekend to do this, and the idea is to then try and talk to as many other people throughout the country doing it at the same time. And you keep a log, you keep score, and some clubs do one or two little stations. It's just a great way to get out. And some, I'm trying to remember what was the one I talked to in Maryland, it was like 26 simultaneous operating radios. 26 AMDC? Yeah. It's insane. And then, of course, the third is just an excuse to party. Much like we have LAN parties or whatever, you get out and you go and you have fun. People will bring out picnic dinners and just generally have a good time. And the night owls get to operate into the night. Some people will sleep. It's good stuff. But this particular one was taken actually in Hawaii, this station out there. So. You don't have to necessarily think of it as, just going out and camping in grungy, distant, who knows, whatever. This looks like a pretty sweet place to be. So, much like we have our Linux users groups throughout the community, amateur radio has radio clubs, very much the similar purpose. Everybody organizing for common purpose to share technical information and build that social network around that. There are these radio clubs in places throughout the country and throughout the world. So I would encourage you, if you're interested, and I'll get some more information on this later and talk to look up where your ham radio club is and talk to them. about what might be interesting. And of course, much like we have our Linux Fest here, we also have Ham Fests, where we get together and there's often a sales component. People will come and sell off some of their old gear. The vendors will come and exhibit their newest gear. And it pleases me to be giving this talk here in Ohio. Because for all of you amateurs out there, I bet I have but to say one word to you to bring a smile to everyone's face. Dayton, yes! The world's largest gathering of amateur radio operators on the entire planet happens not an hour's drive from here. It's wonderful. I was actually here for this year's Dayton. We'll get back to that a little later on. So, yeah, as I said, huge convention. This is the Hera Arena Complex in Dayton, and you see all of the cars parked out around there. A lot of that are the trunk sales where people are selling off their old wares. Some of that's just base parking, and then, of course, all of that building space is packed full of vendors. It's huge. And as I said, worldwide. This is a group from the country of Brazil getting one last picture before they hop back on the bus to head back to the airport to fly home from Dayton, actually, this past year. So, much as we have different languages for communicating amongst ourselves throughout the world, and we have different languages for communicating these concepts among technology either. So, a lot of you will probably find this construct eminently familiar, the good old-fashioned hello world. And so, when you're speaking about radios, or mostly speaking about electronics in general, we use the schematic diagram. This is essentially hello world for electronics. Turn on a light. You can get a little more advanced and make a light blink, but that's ICs. We have the building blocks. We build up from there. You go from lights to blinking lights to radios that can talk all over the planet. So many of you have seen the ham radio section in your favorite distro. And you see antenna visualization, things like basic calculations. That's what a lot of the early software was. But as the software has come to progress, much of our software revolves around the conversion of a binary bit stream to some sort of analog to be sent over the radio waves. We actually had an example of this at the beginning of my talk here. This is a program called FLDigi. It is used to send primarily text. There's some small imaging capabilities across the shortwave ham bands. So you're essentially now able to, instead of having to go from hop to hop to hop on the internet, you're able to send this text directly along long paths around the world. Now, of course, obviously not as reliable, but that's part of the fun. But it's interesting that so many of these programs now involve typing text to the other parts of the world. So it seems like we actually talk now more to our phones and more directly to electronics rather than to each other. But a lot of us hams still like to talk to each other. It keeps with the humanity, keeps us connected. So, which kind of brings me back to Dayton. I kind of have to fanboy here. Yes, this was taken at Dayton 2013. My friend was kind enough to take the picture. And this is none other than Bruce Perens, who was at Dayton. So why was he in the middle of Ohio, other than, well, obviously being at the Hamfest? Well, let's go back a little bit in recent history and see some of the developments in radio, in amateur radio. This is the most packed slide, I promise you. I don't like walls of text. But this basically details the highlights of the development of something called D-Star. It has been interesting in that it's an attempt to bring new digital to a realm that's been predominantly analog for a long amount of time. So obviously this started back in 99 when they started developing the specs. And then in 2001, we actually get a protocol. And and then in 2004, hardware release. So, you know, we're still looking at about 10 years ago that this all started. But the problem is, are these standards open? You know, everybody here likes open standards, open source, open systems, so we can all freely interconnect. Well, the first versions of some of the DSTAR system were largely proprietary in how we connect to the internet. You know, ICOM basically had their own way of doing it, and that was kind of that. But we're enterprising folk. We can find our ways around this. Flinging bits around the internet, in the grand scheme, isn't all that hard. And as I said, the protocol itself is open. It is a published standard. Anyone may implement the protocol. And this is actually a sample of the header for the actual interface. But you notice this bit where there are voice frames. Because again, I said, we all like to talk. The problem is with radios, you have a very finite amount of bandwidth. And getting voice crunched down into that amount of bandwidth is not an easy feat. Getting things down below about 4 to 5 kilobits is the real trick. And so when Jarl and ICOM started developing the standard, they needed a way to do this. And unfortunately, at that time, there was no open method for doing this. So which brings us to our problem. This is the ultimate black box, in both figurative and literal. The essential function of this device is to take voice that's been digitized in, compress it down, and kick it back out. How this box does that is a trade secret. No one can know this. And it makes life interesting because in the FCC regulations, it says that any protocol, any messages, any data you send over the airwaves must be freely decodable by any other station. So there was some argument about all this that, well, if it's a trade secret, how can we know? How can we implement? How can we decode this? And they said, well, you can just go buy the chip. And anybody can buy the chip. It's not restricted. So somebody created a product called the DV dongle. This device's sole purpose in life is to take that digitized data from your headset, your computer, what have you, and run it through the process. You can see the AMBI chip and a couple other processing chips on here, and return that data, return the compressed data or the decompressed data, it goes both ways, so that anyone can then participate. That single hunk of equipment, that single tiny box, is $200. So now, if we want to implement a compatible interface, we have to go spend $200 just to be able to get data in and out of the black box. Not cool. So what are we as the open source community to do? Well, of course, we try and figure out how to do it ourselves. So Bruce, our friend, put out a call for somebody to try and implement such a voice coder. So again, we're having to compress voice down to a very, very tiny stream. So it's hard to show a voice coder, but this is essentially the block diagram of the magic voodoo. But what it essentially does is looks at the sine waves of the speech being emitted, characterizes them, and sends that characterization down the link as opposed to trying to send the raw waveforms. Now, this codec is only in alpha, but it was developed down in Australia by a gentleman named David Rowe. And despite it being in alpha, this thing works remarkably well. He's got a mode that is currently working at 1.2 kilobits. And is quite intelligible. There is an implementation of this called FreeDV. FreeDV is a piece of software you can go download from the net right now. and you can use your sound card, plug it up to your radio. Many of you hams, if you're doing HF work, how many of you do PSK31 or other types of digital modes? Maybe some other modes like you heard at this, okay, a handful of you. So you've already got half of what you need for running this. But the other half is you still then need to get the sound from your mouth into the machine to digitize. So you would need either a second sound card or a USB headset, because the USB headset essentially acts as that second sound card. So what you see here is the waterfall form showing the audio spectrum, that very similar to that FL Digi that I showed earlier in the talk. And this works really well, much to my surprise at first. This is actually what got me back into doing shortwave, doing HF. The current version uses a 1600 or 1.6 kilobit per second mode that's doing 1.3 kilobits, so slightly faster than that 1200, of voice, and the rest is forward error correction, so that as you have small dropouts, those little bursts of static, what have you, then you'll still be able to recover an intelligible voice, even when it's down. I've been able to copy stuff when that signal noise ratio is down around 3 or 4. Obviously, then as it gets higher, it's easier to copy, but you can be listening by your ear to the modem tones that are coming through. It sounds kind of like a buzzsaw. You can just barely hear it coming up over the noise floor, but and in your other ear, you're still hearing voice come across. It sometimes gets a little choppy, but it works surprisingly well. But there's still more work to do. As I said, the codec itself is still in alpha. It's not yet released. So we need a lot of testing of that, of the actual codec, to see what ways we can make it break. Because obviously there's no way to model every voice on the planet. It breaks down in certain ways and modes for different tones. And as I said, this was being done on the FreeDV is HF, shortwave. The D-Star primarily concerns itself with VHF and UHF. So coming up with the ways, the protocols and whatnot, to transmit this data over this different band, because you're dealing with different distances, different RF characteristics, the way you modulate that data is going to be a little different. And right now, there's very active discussion on the digital voice group. We use a Google Groups group to do this discussion, and there are ideas being thrown out every day. Not thrown out as a discard, but thrown out there as, hey, what if we try this? What if we try that? I've seen some very interesting stuff. I've seen some stuff like, ooh, hey, well, let's do that. I've even thrown out a few myself. I'm not as much a hardware guy. I work more up in the software. But together, we're all getting it done as a community and innovating again. So if you want to get involved, what can you do? Like I said, all the source code's out there. But if you want to start playing with this on the air, those of you who aren't licensed, I encourage you to go and get your ham radio license. It is not difficult to do, but yes, there is a test involved. You will have to sit for a 35-question multiple choice test over things like basic electronics theory and some antenna theory, some basic rules and regs. There's a little bit of stuff about in those rules about what frequencies you are and are not allowed to transmit on. Some of that's rote memorization, but any kind of basic physics or basic electronics exposure at all will get you a leg up on that. If you haven't seen any of it all, that's fine. All of the questions, all of the study guides are out there available. So if you're the sort that is able to read and cram for a test, this no-nonsense study guide is really awesome. What they basically did is took the question pool. So there's the large pool of questions they draw from to render the different exams. Rewrote all the questions in narrative form to explain the concept and the answer, and basically explains it all right like that. The technician and general, there are three classes, technician, general, and extra. The basic class is the technician that needs that 35-question test. Obviously, as you get more advanced, they're a little bit more difficult. But the technician and general are free to download. The extra you can pay a little bit for. So if you sit down, you read it through, you study, hey, man, this is making sense. I love this. This is going to be fun. Go ahead and actually take a practice test. You can go online, any of the rankings, take a practice test. It'll grade it for you. It'll break it out by section, let you know which, whether you're weak on the theory or maybe the rules or what have you, so you know what to go back and study. And so you'll be able to get up to speed in no time. Now, if you're not the sort who can just cram it in like that, you need a more hands-on, you need a more teaching-type environment. Again, back to those radio clubs. A lot of the radio clubs throughout the country will do radio schools. Essentially, it'll be some number of weeks. Some of them have day-long crams, but usually it's maybe a month or two long, once or twice a week. And they'll go through all the different theory. You can ask questions. You can work some of the problems and really sit down and try and learn how it's going. And then because it's the club full of people who have been doing this, you'll be able to ask questions and not just, oh, well, this is an interesting bit of theory, but also, well, this is what I've done with this. This is how this works in real life. And, hey, you want to go try some stuff out. The ARRL is sort of the group here in the United States, analogous to that journal that I mentioned earlier. They have listings of all the different clubs in the air in all over the country that might have these exams, that have the exam sessions, that have the teaching sessions, and again, the list of clubs just in general, so you can go give it a try. And lastly, just as I mentioned, this was actually a sticker that I started seeing both at Dayton and at some of the Linux Fests a few years ago. Linux Journal has an amateur radio community active. That's actually the editor's call sign there on the penguin there. And so once you've got your license and you want to start poking at this, you can come here and see kind of what wide variety of things people are doing. So with that, anybody got any questions? The question is there Morse code requirements? And as of now, no. Back in the early days, you did have to pass a Morse code test that was increasing in speed based on the ranks. Maybe about 15 or 20 years ago, they knocked it down to where it was 5 words a minute across the board. And then within the last 5, something like that, they eliminated the Morse code requirement altogether. So the only thing you need to know is the basic theory. There is still a very active Morse code community out there, so if you still want to give it a try, once you're licensed for the general to get up on the HF band, you could certainly jump in and try your hand at it. Now the question is about renewals. The license itself has to be renewed every 10 years. You do not have to retest. So you have to do it every 10 years. There's a 2-year grace period. But basically all you have to do is fill out a form saying, hey, I'd like to renew my license, and you can actually do that on the web now. So you've got the form for renewing and also for changing address, so it's pretty easy in that regard. But yeah, every 10 years.
Pretty sure that you do have to retest if you let the grace period expire.
Yes, if you let the grace period expire, then your license is canceled, and you have to start from the beginning. But so as long as you, every 10 years, you keep an eye on that renewal date, you just send the form in, you're good to go.
You were talking about the development of that codec. Mm-hmm. Was there any experimentation with using some of the other open source codecs like
Speak? So the question is, in the development of a new codec, was any of the other codecs looked into for experimenting? In the case of D-Star, I think there was some very brief experimentation using Speaks. Now the problem there is Speaks only gets you down to about 4 kilobits per second. And that's still pretty big, and Speaks just really didn't do as well down at those lower bit rates, so it started to get muffled and unintelligible. And even now we see newer codecs like Opus being released that are based on the Silk and Kelp combination. And the lower floor for that is actually 6 kilobits. So, yes, nobody likes to reinvent the wheel, and we like to stand on the shoulders of giants where possible, but there's just it is a difficult problem space to get things crammed down that low. And a lot of the work that was done on that is, interestingly enough, is actually pretty old. So I mentioned the Codec 2 and the sinusoidal modeling. The current code base is largely based on research that David did as part of his PhD thesis 30 years ago. And the research he did was actually based on stuff that was 10 and 20 years older than that. So what happens is a lot of these proprietary codecs, you know, take the basic, well-known public domain knowledge, sprinkle a little bit of secret sauce in, and then patent the whole thing. So getting the voice down this low is a bit of a niche, so it's taken some time to kind of get off the ground, but we're getting there. We're definitely getting there. Rig control software for Linux, yes. There is, if you go into the ham radio section of your distro, there is a lot of it. It's all based on something called Hamlib, where they have basically taken the various different manufacturers' protocols, abstracted out into a common interface, and then, yes, you've got command line tools, you've got GUI tools, and I mentioned FLDigi. It links through Hamlib, and actually, wind back here. If you see kind of here, you know, the rig frequency, you can key that in. If you have it linked to Hamlib, you can click there and your radio will track with you. Sir?
I've been really interested in digital, like analog switch block part, and digitized is also really interesting, but data is
right.
Something, and for years and years, hands were using AF25.
Right.
I've never really been interested in that. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So D-Star, so you mentioned AX25, you're talking about the digital modes as a whole. Yeah, so, well, and the interesting thing is, you know, TCP was embedded in AX25, which then was sent over usually Bell 202. So pretty old standard, 1200 baud. And there was a standard for 9600 baud done by a fellow with call sign G3RUH. It's sort of the currently existing standard. But there are some performance issues with it. It is very finicky to tune. It drifts out easily enough, so it's difficult to get those high data rates you need. And especially, you know, if you're using TCP and you're doing a lot of protocol encapsulation, you need the extra bandwidth. So D-Star is based on a modulation called GMSK, Gaussian Minimum Shift Keying, that narrows the bandwidth a little bit, and D-Star actually operates at a carrier bit rate of 4800 baud. So not quite up to the full 9600. So then that's actually split between the voice and there's a low bit rate data. So there are those that argue that D-Star isn't the optimum way to do it, because especially when you're doing digital voice, all that data goes idle and vice versa. There's nothing stopping you from taking your old AX25 and modulating the GMSK, it's just nobody's done it. These modes are much lower bit rate. For HF, I think some of the highest ones here, you might get upwards of maybe a kilobit if you're lucky on some of them. As the modes get wider, you start to chew through more bandwidth. A lot of this is focused on narrowing the bandwidth so that you can punch more signal through so it gets through reliably, but in order to do that, you sacrifice bandwidth. So that's sort of your continuum there. Right. HSMM. Okay.
I'm just curious, you know, anything from that space, because that's just Ethernet. Maybe that can come down to pretty low.
Right. So HSMM, high-speed multimedia, is essentially repurposing common off-the-shelf 2.4 gigahertz wireless gear. Because the first couple of channels actually share both Part 15 and Part 97, Part 97 being the FCC regs that govern amateur radio, and 15 are the unmanaged ISM instrumental something medical. Anyway, those first two channels are shared, so that hams can run more power there as long as they legally identify. As for bringing those protocols down, there's some potential for that. I'm not sure, but I do know there is a product that is in will be taking orders soon called the UDR 56K. It's done by a company called Northwest Digital Radio, and they are basically trying to build, as the name suggests, something that starts off around 56K that runs in UHF. I don't know what their air protocol is going to be, but I heard some rumors that it's basically going to run, you know, slightly wider channel widths. It's kind of an amalgam. It's not quite software-defined radio because the actual RF stuff's pretty fixed, but it's also then got an embedded Linux controller on it that you can program up for the different modes. So it's going to be very interesting to see what they do with that sort of thing, you know, and what kind of stuff takes off there. But yeah, give that a look-see and see if that might be a path forward on the next generation. Way to back there. So yeah, basically HSMM doing some interesting work with, again, the common off-the-shelf equipment and kind of repurposing. So you've got, that's, again, speaks to the diversity of what's going on in the ham radio space. You've got one group that's saying, well, let's work with some of these other bands, let's innovate, let's create new protocols. You guys are saying, well, you know, we've got all this gear that works in our space already, let's tweak it. And some of that's probably not too dissimilar to taking a lot of the old commercial radios out of, you know, old city trucks and things like that, and retuning those to work in the ham bands as well. So you've got the kind of the history of both of that, both the innovation and the repurposing. Sorry. Questions about SDR and some of these cable TV tuners. Sadly, I have not had a chance to play with that. The fundamental concept there is because everything's gone more and more software, these chips are getting more and more programmable. What it basically has is an RF receiver that's fairly wide band that people are then writing software for that lets you tune fairly widely, as wide or as narrow as you want, play with the characteristics of that RF signal, again, as much as you want, and the sky's the limit there as well. So the SDR, software-defined radio, kind of, again, blurring that line of the software and hardware. Any other questions, comments, concerns? Yes.
I'm curious if with something like Echo, I recently got into.
I was using it on the way down up here, in fact.
Yeah, well, and what I've been able to do is get some repeaters for Echo. And I wonder if there are any HF transceivers that are available.
HF transceivers on Echo Link. I don't think the rules. You have something to.
Actually, they are a couple. The only problem is it's receive only.
Right. So you can receive basically remote monitors. Yeah, I think there's some weirdness with the transmission rules, especially because of the license classes. That gets into third-party retransmission and voodoo
but,
there.
But the thing is you can actually, if you're a general or a van, you just email and copy your license. They'll put you in his server.
In the ACL, okay.
Control his system.
Okay.
And basically, you are, the thing is, with that Echo on the HF, you type in the commands in the command window, and you actually change bird speed, change the band, and the
Nine
yards. But you can do that at receive only for now.
Okay. So yeah, the nice thing with Echo Link, for those of you who don't know, Echo Link is a piece of software that was originally developed for Windows only, but is essentially voice over IP for the ham radio space. So instead of picking up the handset, it's connected to the push to talk and the transmit and receive. But it also has a small text channel along with it. And you can usually that channel is used for operators if they were communicating directly to just type to each other if the voice got a little choppy or what have you. But in this case, it can also be used as a command module, much like an IRC bot or even like a rudimentary telnet interface riding alongside. And I know, so some of these some of the EchoLink systems, even on VHF and UHF, are very highly locked down so that just not every random person come on. You have to contact the operator and let them know what you're trying to do and whatnot. So again, the varying openness, but and there are systems that even if they're not publicly shared, where you could potentially control your own radio. It's a combination of something like these hamlib interfaces to actually run the radio and then a simple voice link that would be just for you to control your station. Like if you're at work on your lunch hour and decide you want to, you know, see how the bands are doing, you poke around and then go back to work when you're done. Of EchoLink, there is a piece of software called SVXLink. I have not had a chance to work with it, but it is EchoLink compatible. And it actually uses speaks if it detects that the far end is also an SVX link node, so you get a little bit better compression. But if you just want to do a quick trial, EchoLink actually runs pretty well in Wine.
SVX link is meant to be an EchoLink server and active repeater controller. Mm-hmm. It has a companion program called QCell, which is meant to be an end user program. And QCell is fairly
yeah, I'm hoping to play with that soon because I'd love to just rig it up so the SVX link instead of the EchoLink system, and then as some of these new digital protocols get developed, it would be nice to basically have digital end to end, and so that instead of having to digitize the analog, kick it back out, etc., you get the same signal all the way across. How are we doing on time? Okay. Most of the modern stuff now has some sort of rig control. You can look at the data sheet of the brochure and see if they talk about computer control. CAT was Yaesu specific, I think. It was computer automated. ICOM calls it that too. But most of them will say it. But the other thing would be to actually go to the hamlib website and see what they list as supported devices.
What is a popular digital voice with 4HF? I'm aware of, you know, P25, if you really want to drop the money on that stuff. Mm-hmm. There's DMR, Moto Turbo, and everything like that. And V-Star for HF is our popular digital voice mode.
Pretty much right now on HF, FreeDV is it. There were actually a couple of programs. One was FDM-DV and the other was WinDRM. We'll start with WinDRM. It was based on a standard that they were looking at in Europe for digital broadcast of voice, digital radio mondial, but it was a wider band and they essentially narrowed that protocol. The problem there is sync time. It takes 2 to 3 seconds to get synced. So they wanted to build something that had a much faster sync, and so someone built FDM-DV. And that is actually, that modem is the precursor of what is FreeDV. It's a very similar, you know, modulation. It has near-instant sync times. And so those kind of gave way when FreeDV came on the scene, mostly because a lot of the early experimentation was with these older codecs. Speaks you couldn't really get down crammed that well. They did some work with DRM, but FDM-DV really couldn't do it. You had there was one called MELP that was patent encumbered, and they actually had that patent enforced on them, shall we say. So that's actually not in use anymore. So once Codec 2 came on the scene, they developed free, because the other problem is WinDRM and FDM-DV were not open source. You could get download the EXE, couldn't get the source code. So this is all now being developed in the open. Everybody can get in there and make tweaks and do what they need to do.
Yeah, I know V-Star is being started to be used on HF, the
IC7100. And so is that...
Yeah, 7100.
You said that's HF, but is that basically just 10 meters?
That's
because I think, because 10 meters, we're talking about the different frequency bands, 10 meters, 29-point-ish megahertz is in kind of the gray, it's the kind of the transition between our VHF, UHF modes and your HF modes, where you can get away with a little bit more bandwidth there. As a technician, that basic class, you can operate there legally, so you can get a little bit more distance. It is kind of a gray area, because you can run FM voice there on certain parts of the band if you're a general. So the problem is D-Star, even at 4800 GMSK, you're still looking at a wider bandwidth than is dictated by a standard HF transmission. Even the voice band, you still have to be under, I think it's like 3K.
Yeah, it's relatively new radio, so I'm not exactly sure. I know if there already are D-Star HF now.
Okay. I'll have to look into that then, see what they're doing, because D-Star strikes me as one of those kind of wider modes. D-Star, yeah, it's tricky because you have to know what that last character is, and you have to have the radio all pre-programmed. It's not as easy as just twiddling the dial, especially if you're going mobile. You don't want to be fussing with that interface. You just want to, so you got to... If both are near an internet gateway, yes.
Yeah.
That's kind of one of the interesting philosophical discussions about ham radio is, you have the Echo link, you have the D-Star link, and you have these internet links of repeaters, and some say, well, that's not radio. But then again, you have some of these systems that are far apart that you can go ahead and use to interconnect, and sometimes internet is the only way. The thing that... gave me pause is at Dayton, I actually spoke with the D-Star folk and asked them, can you build a linked D-Star system using only RF components? And the answer was a very qualified yes. The ICOM sells a repeater-to-repeater interconnect that operates at 10 gigahertz. And you get nice bandwidth and all, it's $5,000. Per site. So if you want to link two repeaters together, drop 10K and link it. So yeah, and ICOM freely admits, yeah, nobody buys this. We know that. So internet's cheap. Internet is, as commodity, it's fairly inexpensive to then go ahead and link these. So what I'm kind of hoping is that as we start to develop some more of these open standards, we have an eye toward doing RF linking as well as internet linking, so we get more of a balance back. Because I know where I'm at in central North Carolina, there's a fairly active set of linked systems. There's one called the Carolina 440 Net. You can pretty much drive, if the system is completely up, from the western part of the triangle down I-40 all the way to the coast and still have RF coverage on those repeaters.
Actually, if I'm not mistaken, the one you're talking about is actually what you call like
unit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know.
It's linked all the way up through this area.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's just it. I remember when I lived up here many years ago, there was a 145-19, the Mighty Link.
Yep.
That was really impressive. I remember sitting in Bowling Green talking to my dad in Dayton. He was just getting ready to come home. Only problem there is because every one of those hops incurs audio degradation. What did he just say? So if we can get these digital codec to the point where it's relatively clear sounding, and you have good, clean, at every hop that signal's regenerated because it's digital, you can check the forward error correction, recreate it, and kick it down, it's going to sound just the same as it would on any repeater system. So, again, D-Star already does this, does it with the help of internet. Echolink is doing this. By merely reducing the number of hops. With Echolink, you're still going through an analog-digital conversion, then digital-analog conversion at the other end. But I'm just thinking of even my one local repeater system down in North Carolina. They have a couple of remote receive sites, and they're always having to tweak the audio level so that everybody comes in at a nice stable level depending on what site you're at. Imagine with digital, as long as that endpoint is tweaked, and that's then incumbent on the user, and if it comes from the factory tuned, you're golden. I think we're running out of time. Any other last questions? APRS, descended of the original packet systems. Again, still only 1,200 baud. No forward error correction, but very, very widely used. He mentioned that he saw my signal coming up. Lots of equipment out there. Oh, APRS Linux client, yes. It's called X-Aster, the X Amateur Station Tracking and Information Reporting. X-Aster, yeah. I don't know who thought that one up. But very featureful. The GUI toolkit's a little old. Might be a little finicky to get running on modern systems, but very featureful. Good stuff. Okay, so I have a lot of stuff up here. For those interested, I have some issues of QST, the magazine put out by the ARRL for amateur radio. I also have some brochures if you're, for those of you who might be interested in getting a license or know someone who might want to, or just general information about amateur radio, please feel free to take. And thank you all so much for coming this afternoon.